All rise. And now the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in session.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here this morning on case 7-2288, State of Ohio versus Donna Marie Roberts. For the appellant, Mr. Doughton.
Good morning, Your Honors. On behalf of Ms. Roberts with Robert Dixon, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today on kind of a unique issue for the court. This court had previously reversed Ms. Roberts' case because the judge had not filed an independent review, also had not allowed allocution until after the independent report had been filed. So the case was remanded back to the trial court. The issue that's kind of unique here today is during the preparation for the resentencing, we discovered a great deal of potentially very strong mitigation evidence. The issue is, for us, guidance for courts and the further, and for, frankly, defense counsel, is what do you do? What's the proper thing to do with this information?
Was there a motion to reopen the case for the purposes of presentation, the mitigation phase?
There was. There was.
And that was denied?
It was denied. So what happened, after that was denied, we'd asked for a psychologist. It was denied. We asked for a psychologist for competency. It was denied. The usual mitigation, it was denied. The trial court's belief was that this court's order was very restrictive, that according to the judge, he was simply to hear the allocution with nothing else and write the independent decision. What I'd like to do this morning, in a way, is to work backwards. And what I mean by that is to presume for this moment that the issue was that restrictive. And what can the proffered materials be used as? What I'd like to address is that this court has an independent duty by the legislature to review all appropriate evidence, both aggravating and mitigating.
She waived the original presentation, correct?
She waived the presentation of mitigation. She wasn't a volunteer.
Pardon me?
She was not a volunteer, but she restricted greatly what was put on at the original trial. That's correct. This court had found that it was a valid waiver of the evidence in the first trial. She did not waive in this case. As you know, there were
I understand she didn't waive in this case, but that wasn't before the court. When this court remanded for resentencing, it was on a very limited instruction on what to do, and the error that was brought to, the proposition that was brought to the court, this court, we acted on, sent it back, and the trial court was to comply with that.
That's correct.
All right, and so now, in essence, your client is asking for a second opportunity to present mitigating evidence that she waived the presentation of previously.
That's correct. But in addition to that, and here's the issue with the allocution, in this case, she did stand up and she did present in her allocution, I think there were 11 cited in the brief, evidence of which this court would normally find to be mitigating. So the question is, clearly, this court required allocution for the judge to consider what she had to say as mitigating. Otherwise, there would be no point in the allocution. To do that, if the allocution be given any weight, it needs to be corroborated. In this case, in the independent...
Was there any evidence that the state presented contrary to what she stated in her allocution?
No.
So there was no contradictory
information
before the court?
No.
The court, if it chose to do, could assume everything that she stated in the allocution was correct.
Well, but the state didn't do that, in all fairness to the state, because the judge... I'm sorry. The state did not really have the opportunity to put in contradictory evidence because the court had made clear to the parties very clearly that he wasn't going to consider these before we went out there for this resentencing. The problem with the restriction is in the independent opinion, the court didn't cite to a single thing that she said. The court didn't acknowledge anything that she had said in her allocution to consider it and even give it no weight. The 2929.03F requires a court to identify the mitigating factors or potential mitigating factors, and then specify what weight, if any, the court gave to that factor, and then it's required to give specific reasons on why the aggravating circumstance outweigh the mitigation. It wasn't done.
So are you essentially saying this is a do-over for the same reason, essentially, that we sent it back the last time?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, you know, the court didn't send it back for rubber stamping. This court has made very clear that allocution is a serious thing, and it must be considered, and it must be provided before the independent weighing is done by the trial court. And, again, the statute shall. The statute indicates they shall consider these matters. The problem we have here is it's hard for the court to understand the weight of what she was saying without any corroboration, without any background, without knowing that she wasn't making stuff up to the court merely to try to, you know, get something on the record to avoid the death penalty.
Counsel, don't you open a window here that this court has said we don't want open, in the sense that res judicata applies to what could have, should have, and would have been said at the first sentencing. Now you've got a defendant saying, I'm going to say nothing at the first sentencing. And in subsequent sentencings, they say, well, we've reconsidered, and what we should have said, we want to say now.
In fact, Ms. Roberts did say something. She did make an unsworn statement at the first sentencing, which the judge alluded to in his independent opinion. So she did not waive her unsworn statement at the first hearing. Second of all, here's a problem with res judicata. If we don't raise it, there's a danger that we could have raised it. You know, right now, the federal courts do not consider res judicata in Ohio a bar, because if it's not raised on direct appeal, it's waived because it could have been. If it is raised, it's waived because it was raised on direct appeal. This puts us, what do we do? And so what we are doing is raising it every place.
So essentially, you're saying you're standing here raising these things because you have to.
One.
For further litigation in the federal courts.
No, we're raising these things because, one, we think it's proper. You know, the ABA guidelines, Strickland, Wiggins, both say it is the duty of the sentencing attorney, which was us, to do a complete investigation. And if for whatever reason it's not put forth, we have to make it part of the record. I mean, it's our duty to do so. Part of that duty, which I tried making, is that this court, in its independent review, even if there's a volunteer, even if the judge doesn't consider it, has to have before it the evidence to do its independent weighing.
Well, if she hadn't waived the presentation of mitigation first time around,
yes,
and it just hadn't been made, you would have an argument about ineffective assistance, and you would still have the same dilemma as to whether or not you attempt to open that up.
Sure.
When you were back at the trial court, it's presently, and that would be more efficient than waiting to 2 or 3 years later to make a ineffective assistance of counsel, but you don't have ineffective assistance of counsel here.
Here's the danger. This court found a waiver the first time. The problem is, to be a waiver, obviously it has to be knowing, intelligent waiver. If the lawyers didn't do the investigation, she didn't know what she was waiving. She was unaware of what could have been presented on her behalf. You know, that is why it's absolutely important for this court's review and for the issue, is that what evidence that you obtained, you have to make part of the record. when we are preparing for the sentence, the remand sentencing hearing, we come across all this which nobody knew about before. Some of it, in all fairness, was the prison record, so it was, you know, post, the lawyers couldn't have. And so at that point in time, we have the evidence. She has not been sentenced yet, so that it's our obligation to place that before the sentencing court, because there's been no sentence in this case yet, that the evidence that she waived the first time was none of this. It was none of this.
What specifically would have changed her mind that you discovered?
Well, if you're asking my opinion, I'd love to tell you. There's real mental health problems here. There's severe depression, there's bipolar, there's post-traumatic stress, and that's why it's incumbent on defense counsel to sit down, get professional help, explain the situation. Death penalty is complicated. The mitigation is complicated. The aggravating factors, mitigating factors is very complicated. You can get, you know, when somebody's referred for watch on a competency issue, they actually have competency school where they sit down there and explain to them the defense lawyers does this so they can recite it. The fact that they can recite a judge hears the case, a jury hears the case, a lawyer, does not mean they understand the nuances of a capital case or any other case. So the difference, in my opinion, is that, without tooting our own horn, is you take the time, you get assistant help, and you explain to her. It takes a long time with any client, let alone with a client with the mental deficiencies. Her IQ, according to Social Security records, was 55. Her verbal was 79, but her IQ was 55. How the problem is she'd had these traumatic head injuries, that her husband had written a letter to the Social Security Board, the victim in this case, saying that ever since there was this severe accident, she's not acting the same. She can't remember.
Where is all this in the record, Mr.
It's in the Social Security records that we've proffered.
Okay.
We proffered. It's part of the record in this case.
But the remand from this court, it wasn't limited to the allocution, was it? There was some involvement of the state,
correct,
in the preparation of the court's sentencing memorandum.
Correct.
And because it wasn't an independent document generated by the court, it was tainted, and we remanded this for a resentencing to give the defendant the opportunity of allocution and
correct
preparation of a proper sentencing memorandum.
That's correct.
So, and then as I review this, the court also undertook to have your client examined for competency prior to this all occurring the second time. Am I right about that?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure about the competency, but I think in any...
Was there not a competency examination?
There was, but we requested it. You know, we requested.
Okay. And the court granted it.
The court granted it. And
so the court made a finding that your client at the time of the resentencing was competent.
We had asked for an independent, and in the competency hearing, it turned out that the court clinician had not considered many of the records, including the Social Security records. Social Security found her disabled because of a mental disability. They weren't aware of all this information. There was a report that was part...
I understand that, but as far as the court at the time of resentencing...
That's correct.
It made a determination that your client was competent...
That is correct.
...for purposes of that proceeding.
That's correct.
And then the court prepared its own independent sentencing memorandum subsequent to the resentencing and your client's getting the right of allocution.
That's correct.
So what you're saying is... You wanted to reopen the entire mitigation hearing based on the remand because of the records that you discovered from Social Security.
I don't know, in the jail records that occurred post the first sentence. I'm not saying reopen. We're saying supplement. Supplement. And the distinction is important because, again, this court ordered allocution. Absolutely, without question, this court believes that what is said in allocution may be used for the mitigation consideration. She mentioned we listed 11, of mitigating factors that this court has found can consist of mitigating factors. In order for the judge to properly evaluate the credibility, the accuracy of what she is saying, It needed to have corroboration. It needed to know she didn't make up all this stuff when she stood up there, because otherwise the court doesn't have a fair basis to assess the allocution.
But, counsel, don't you see the road you're going down if you want to bring in post-sentence prison records? Say somebody's in prison for 20 years. Are they now allowed to come on a resentencing and saying, I've been a model prisoner, so I shouldn't be here?
Our point is it's not post-sentencing. She was never sentenced the first time. There was never a final sentencing. This is pre-sentence information. So that all the stuff from the prison records, the hallucinations, the amount of drugs that she was taking, the treatment that she had, her references to, you know, Oakwood, it's all pre-sentence.
Well, you're saying she wasn't pre-sentenced or she wasn't sentenced.
That's right.
What's she doing in jail?
This court sent her back for resentence. This court did not do an independent weighing.
I understand. I don't want to play word games sure. with you, but when you resentence, does that not imply you've been sentenced?
Not validly, I guess is my point, that the first sentence was void, therefore there's no accurate sentence.
Please, don't use that
word. Watch yourself.
Okay.
If you're looking at the sentencing entry, we have a 24-page entry that the judge has provided here on the second time, and this is the judge's own words this time,
That's
not
correct.
The prosecutor's words. Was there a statement by your client to the judge before this second entry was prepared?
That's correct. There was.
And that's what I'm wondering. Are you saying that under 292903F, the second entry here is still deficient?
Yes. But the basis for that deficiency is that the judge didn't follow the statutory requirements.
I don't see anything here that talks about the allocution that was presented to the judge on the second time. This time, we have 24 pages talking about the trial, the
right.
evidence, and so on, and also talking about what the jury heard and the waiver that your client had. There's a statement that there was an acknowledgement that this was a voluntary choice of your client. I mean, the judge says that, but I don't see anything that says, I'm considering the allocution before me now, and then making that determination
sorry,
of the
and that's exactly my point. You know, that's the violation of the statute. That's why the judge didn't follow this court's order in making its independent assessment. Because, again, there were significant factors mentioned by her. There was no waiver by her of these factors, and the judge referred to nothing which this statute requires. In other words, playing devil's advocate, had the judge said, she mentioned that she had been a child abuse victim, she had an imaginary friend, I've considered that, but based on the overall record, I don't find corroboration for that. I'm giving it very little weight.
Well, the corroboration part, I mean, I'm looking for any evidence here. It talks about the A7, for example, the behavior during the course of the trial. There's a statement of slight weight given due to physical abuse under B12.
Right.
But there's nothing that says, pursuant to her statement, the court has considered this as potentially mitigating and then made the weighing statement.
I would agree with that. That's
So it's the idea that really we don't have a proper F entry, and if we don't have a proper F entry, according to the statute, there's no final appealable order.
Yes.
For a sentence.
Yes.
Okay.
It's essentially our position, absolutely.
Okay.
The other issue that I would ask to be addressed is, in this case, we were limited when we asked for an independent on the competency issue, that we had obtained a psychologist, a forensic psychologist with great experience in this area, and to consider all of the records before, to consider everything. I don't know what he would have said, because obviously he wasn't able to review all the records. He did put in an affidavit indicating that he saw strong signs of post-traumatic stress, but he couldn't say it was to a psychological certainty because he hadn't reviewed everything and spent enough time. And I guess the overall, and in a way in concluding here, overall, this court has always taken remands very seriously. They've always taken the requirements of the, of, you know, shall mean shall. This court has many times have said that. And what happened here is the judge got reversed, got hand slapped, if you will, and did the bare minimum to just, you know, get it out of there as quickly as possible, and everything we requested to support was denied. And in a capital presentation, we would argue that that was less than sufficient under the statutory and constitutional requirements. Thank you very much.
Ms. Amos?
May it please the court, on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, the state of Ohio, my name is Luane Annis, and joining me at council table is Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Christopher Becker, who was the trial attorney in this case. Several things that Mr. Downton just said I'd like to take issue with, and I think one of the starring points would be the issue of her so-called mental disability. Proffered into the record of this court is a binder about that thick with the Social Security records. And as pointed out in our brief, Donna Roberts was denied Social Security and disability benefits according to their own document that they submitted. In addition to the denial, there is a reconsideration also available for your review in that document. The only evidence before this court that she was ever awarded any kind of disability benefits was when she got up in allocution and she said, they put me on Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Now, we are talking about a woman who at this point is less than 65 years old and, as is pretty clear from the record, not of low income. She was middle income to...
Are you saying that she was inaccurate when she made those representations? There's nothing in the record proffered by her attorneys that would suggest that she was awarded those benefits.
Awarded is correct. Now, the statement by Dr. Delge, I believe is how you pronounce his name, he did find some evidence that she had some mental issues, but, you know, he also accused her of malingering and confabulation, to quote his document. In that report from Dr. Delge, there is an IQ test which puts Donna Roberts at a 65 IQ. Now, that's 5 points below the presumption of mental retardation in this state, and I would remind the court that Donna took great points to inform the court about how she was on the National Honor Society at school, went to Youngstown State University for 2 years, ran a plastic surgeon's office for over 20 years, ran these businesses in Youngstown and Warren. Now, this is something that I would submit to the court is not consistent with a 65 IQ.
Well, is it the representation that post-accident her IQ diminished? Because she didn't do all these things after she had her automobile accident, did she?
Yeah. Well, no, she wasn't running the plastic surgeon's office in Miami, but she was still running the Warren office of the Warren Greyhound, and she would assist Mr. Fingerhut in running the Youngstown Greyhound. And, in fact, in her unsworn statement that she made to the jury, she made great strides to point out that she was insulted by the fact that the local news media had referred to her as a, quote, restaurant worker. She made it very clear that, that she was running the show and not that she was just some hangers-on. So,
all right. Well, counsel, whether, you know, we're not going to decide here whether she was mentally retarded or what her IQ was, but the question is the deficiency in the sentencing entry that would be mandated by Section F of the statute directing that the court weigh and balance and then, you know, contain in their sentencing entry their conclusions here. And there is no reference to this mitigating evidence, however it came before the court, through her allocution, through the proffer, whatever, that the judge even took that into consideration when he was doing the sentencing for the second time.
I would acknowledge that, no, the judge in the sentencing opinion did not specifically reference the allocution. That is correct. But I would also point out that in the transcript at page 70, it does say that he took into consideration the oral statements.
But we have to look at the F opinion. The F opinion is where everything is supposed to be stated by the trial judge, is it not? And in our remand, we specifically said the right to allocution and the entry under 29-2903F, specifically stating the section of the statute that was to be followed by the judge.
And there is evidence before the court that indeed happened. It's not just the fact that it wasn't referenced in the opinion.
But it has to be referenced in the opinion. The court speaks through its journal entries, through its opinions. And to say that the court may have said something at allocution on the record is not the same as containing in the sentencing opinion pursuant to statute.
Well, the first thing that I would say to that, Your Honor, is that the criminal rule governing allocution does not say that what is allocated needs to be in any sentencing entry, whether it's a criminal, just a passing bad check charge, or a capital case. There's nothing that requires that the allocution need be repeated parsed out, whatever.
The judge in those circumstances for a lesser offense, this is a capital offense, the judge is required to create a sentencing entry, and there's certain things that have to be in it that indicate that the judge has met their responsibility when it comes to the weighing and balancing of the aggravating mitigating circumstances here. The mitigating outweighing, obviously, the aggravating, and that's not here.
Well, for one reason it's not here is because Donna Roberts waived mitigation, waived the right to present mitigation.
Why don't you focus on that here, is the ability to get a second bite at the apple, as you, we might say, with regards to her mitigation presentation, which is what counsel is asking for here.
The first thing that I would note with respect to her second bite of the apple is that even though she stood before the court and talked for 18 pages worth of transcript, she never said to the court, "Don't sentence me to death. I've changed my mind on this. I thought this was a great idea 5 or 6 years ago. I've changed my mind." That was never stated to the court, not by Ms. Roberts and not by her counsel. At no point was there ever a plea for Donna Roberts' life at that second sentencing.
I was going to say, Ms. Ann, what is concerning me is when you look at the F opinion, 24 pages, it seems as though the judge went back and just reviewed what had been done at the trial and specifically talked about the waiver at the trial. When the remand was allow the defendant the opportunity to speak and then prepare an entry talking about the mitigating and aggravating factors, make your appropriate weighing. And it seems as though the judge missed the remand. That's what is of concern to me.
No, I would respectfully disagree. This court sent back very specific instructions to the trial judge, and that was reweigh those aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors and do your own entry and allow her to allocute, which she did. And the fact that she didn't necessarily bring anything to the court's attention that caused him to find it worthy to mention in the second sentencing opinion does not mean that that opinion is flawed in any ways. It specifically mentions the aggravating circumstances as they were presented at trial, and nobody is contesting that there were, versus the mitigating factors, which at trial she had specifically prohibited from bringing forth.
Counsel, I think that's what the problem that I have here is that you say you like the entry, or maybe the entry could be better, but you think it's sufficient, legally sufficient.
I do.
And here we stand this morning, and I think the Chief very accurately indicated you, this court is not going to rule today whether this defendant is mentally competent. and it was not done because it seems to me you are arguing that she is a fine, brilliant person who runs businesses, and they are arguing this is a person who is marginally able to function in life. And I don't see where the trial court answered that question.
It was never properly before the court. It was never presented to the court that she was somebody who was marginally able to get through life. The evidence in the trial
Where's the number 65 coming from?
65?
65, mental capacity. Where is that coming from if it was never presented?
She apparently had an IQ test when she went for the Social Security benefits, which, again, I remind the court, were denied.
And, I understand.
And I also refer again to Dr. Delgray's opinion of her, which was that she was malingering. In other words, she was faking bad. And she didn't do it real well because he obviously picked up on the fact that she was malingering. If, in fact, she was mentally retarded, that, once again, is certainly res judicata barred at this point because she could have raised that in her original trial. She could have raised it at mitigation, but it was virtually a joke given the fact that she's as accomplished as she is, that she was able to do the things in life that she did do, yes, post the accident. She told her jury, you know, when she originally made her unsworn statement that she had had three concussions. Well, this was obviously something that was available for the defense counsel back during the trial to ferret out if, in fact, their client was mentally retarded. I would also like to point out that there was not just the Dr. Gaisley evaluation of her when she came back for resentencing. There was also two reports by Dr. Eberle.
But you understand the question that's being raised this morning is why is not an evaluation of those reports in the sentencing entry?
So, counsel, apparently you're saying that by the judge's silence, by the fact that it's not contained in it, it's indicia of the fact that he did not find it even credible enough to put in a sentencing entry.
Certainly. He gave it absolutely no weight.
We've never required every mitigating factor be listed in the sentencing opinion, have we?
Exactly. No, this court has not.
And the mere fact that it's not in there doesn't mean the court didn't consider it.
Absolutely. But
if the statute itself talks about weighing the mitigating factors and the aggravating circumstances, and we're talking about a death case where the state is to be absolutely scrupulous and the judge in determining what a sentence is, shouldn't it be in? I mean, the court can say we gave it no weight. It was raised, but we gave it no weight. The defendant said, but I give it no weight. At least it shows in the entry what the court did. That's we're talking about a death case, not passing bad checks.
Well, again, I go back to the fact that there is no requirement that all these items that she discussed need to be put into the sentencing entry.
Was there any reference to mitigation in the sentencing entry?
There was a mention of mitigating factors, certainly, which...
Well, yeah, I mean, the judge recited the statutory factors that would be taken into consideration, right?
True.
But he didn't reference specifically anything to Ms. Roberts.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, he pointed out that she was not the principal offender, that she conducted herself properly in court, and that he gave that some weight. But when viewed in the overall aspect of the aggravating circumstances, which this court ordered him to reweigh, that was the bottom line. That they very simply outweighed.
Counsel, the exchange here that you've had with the bench is indicating that her allocution was not discussed by the judge, and the reasonable inference from that is it just didn't cut it. He it was her ramblings. He didn't believe it. Not true that has an IQ of 65 or any of those things. Mr. Doughton is saying that what he was prevented from presenting was not a full-blown mitigation hearing, but he was prevented from presenting any evidence to indicate that what she said in allocution was worthy of being paid attention to, that there was, in fact, available evidence that would indicate what she said to the court was, in fact, true. Isn't that the narrow opening that he's asking for?
That might be the narrow opening, but here's what I would point out to the court is this so-called evidence that I believe the word we could use is the corroborating evidence to what she told the court in allocution. This was all material that could have been presented during her first trial. And the judge was quite scrupulous in looking at your opinion, your instructions, this court's instructions, that I'm to narrow my decision to what was available to me at the time to look at. There was nothing from this court that said, go back and we'll have a free-for-all and she can put in anything she wants. That in and of itself is clear. What is even more clear is the fact that all of this material, particularly regarding the 65 IQ and the fact that she's got depression and she's bipolar and all this was all available to her during her first trial. The implication is in the briefing that she didn't know. Well, of course she knew. Her signature is all over the application for Social Security benefits. And she didn't convince the Social Security people that she was disabled to the point where she was going to be able to collect Social Security benefits. But even if she had, Your Honor, that would have been available for Mr. Ingram and Mr. Juhasz to have entered into evidence at the mitigation, and she pulled the plug on it. She said, no, don't do that.
Looking at the entry again, there is a statement by the trial court that talks about what the unsworn statement was to the jury. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, there was allocution allowed at that time. What we ordered in State versus Roberts, the statement at the beginning, on remand, the trial judge will afford Roberts her right to allocute. The court shall review the evidence, prepare the entry, and so on. In your view, was this court ordering a second right to allocute? That's what is confusing to me here. What is your position on that?
The court was ordering a right to allocute. In fact, what happened at the original sentencing, just as a reminder, was this, that the judge launched into the sentencing entry and, in fact, had said, you know, that the death penalty would be imposed and they would follow the recommendation. There was an interruption for a number of reasons, and they went back into open court. And before the proceedings even adjourned, the judge said to Ms. Roberts, do you have anything to add? And she didn't, basically said, impose the death penalty on me. So there was a little sliver of that allocution.
I'm just trying to figure out if the trial court found that the unsworn statement was her right to allocute, and if he was referring to that, because he refers to that in the entry. And so I'm trying to figure out if he said, okay, I've considered that, and therefore it's in the entry.
Well, by the one side, I don't want to rehash what has already been decided by this court, but let me just point out this to the court. The court decided the State versus Reynolds, which we do cite in our brief, although not necessarily for this proposition. And this court said that, you know, allocution is not necessarily, if there is a failure of a judge to allow the allocution, that's not necessarily fatal to a death penalty. automatically. And what the court pointed out in Reynolds was the fact that, yes, he'd made an unsworn statement. He had submitted a written statement to the court. And I don't know that Mr. Reynolds asked for the death penalty, as Ms. Roberts did several times. She did so in her original unsworn statement to the jurors, you know, basically dared them to impose the death penalty on her. And then when she was permitted those few minutes toward the end of the original sentencing proceeding, she again said, impose the death penalty on me. So to suggest that this is a second allocution, I don't know whether that makes a difference. That is what this court ordered, and we went back for it. And again, I emphasize, she did not say that the death penalty is unfair to me, I don't deserve the death penalty, I've changed my mind. She, you know, went along with all of her life's accomplishments and once again took pot shots at the Howland Police Department, that they basically railroaded her, and, you know, she did all that again. I would also say, Your Honor, into her comments a lot of material that was already in Dr. Gaisley's report. Dr. Gaisley was appointed for purposes of competency at resentencing. And a lot of what she said was parroted from Dr. Gaisley's report on that level. But the court did hear material actually twice regarding the supposed sexual abuse by a cousin and, you know, the spaciness that she had suffered after these accidents. But it also had this court's opinion in front of it that she worked the day this happened to Mr. Fingerhut.
Would our independent review of the evidence here or the material here cure any defect in the opinion?
I think it could if in fact that the court finds a defect. The fact that, first of all, and I think this is the overwhelming point, is this material was available to Donna Roberts prior to her original sentencing. And I think that's the cure-all. We're not hearing anything certainly new here. And anything that she couldn't have if she wanted to have introduced during her original sentencing.
Well, counsel, if my memory serves me correctly, her co-defendant received the death penalty.
Correct.
And that was her motivation for saying, give me the death penalty, too, because of their relationship during the first trial?
During the first trial, that was what she stated. That turned out not to be the truth, if you review Dr. Gaisley's report. What she told Dr. Gaisley was, you know, I don't want to be with those mean girls. I don't want to have to eat the slop. And I'm quoting Dr. Gaisley's report. That's what she said was her true motivation, not that she was trying to make a stand for racial equality or anything like that. She simply wanted the sheltered existence of death row compared to being in general population.
That's once she got there. I mean, that's once at the institution.
It became a matter of record after she got there, Your Honor. But, I mean, I can't stand here and tell you that that was not her true motivation or her original motivation when we're back at the trial court. Yeah.
Well, she wouldn't have experienced the prison life at the trial, original trial. She was in, you know, she wasn't at the women's prison at that point.
No, she wasn't there, but I'm sure she knew full well what she was going to be in for. She was a middle-aged, short lady who'd been used to a very pampered and privileged lifestyle that she knew she was not going to have repeated once she was thrown into the general population of a bunch of criminal women who were probably a lot younger than her by the majority of the population. I think she felt
My point is, when she got back to the second sentencing, mm-hmm. she didn't say at that point, she didn't retract what she said during her first opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor, you're right.
Say, I didn't know what I was saying at the time, affected by my shortcomings in my memory or my, you know, perception, based on my accident. And, you know, I'm offering this mitigating evidence at this point.
That's correct, Your Honor. She basically, you know, took the time to, in effect, toot her own horn, if I can say that, to tell what a, you know, stellar life that she'd live. And, of course, again, I emphasize and take shots at the Howland Police Department to say that the chief investigating officer, Paul Monroe, was basically doing this case just to have himself promoted chief of the township. And
that was during her second allocution.
She did that twice. She did that during her unsworn statement to the jury, and then did it again when she came back for purposes of resentencing. That seemed to be a common theme.
Let me ask you, at a her second opportunity, there would have been nothing to preclude her from saying, you know, I've had these concussions and I have a problem and I have all these records with me, and let me quote from these records telling you what this doctor said about me or that doctor said about me.
There was nothing to stop
her. She could
her.
Have said that at the time. Could she not?
Could have, yes. And quite frankly, she didn't really. You know, she talked about the sexual abuse from the cousin and dad used to beat mom and this sort of thing. But beyond that, she really did not get into those records. And the prison records basically show a chronology of her treatment. They show what medication she was on, the advisories, the cautionary side effects that we all hear on television now for all the commercials. Those are all written in the volume, and those are basically nothing. I mean, they tell what everybody already knew, the fact that she was depressed, she was being treated for depression. And I would certainly point to Dr. Gaisley's report, which said that she was in remission at the point that she was resentenced, that the medication that she was on was working, and that she was doing relatively well. And, in fact, Mr. Doughton even said that when he went into one of the hearings, that she had been doing better. So the question is, if the court's concern is the entry itself, there is no way that a judge is expected to parrot or reproduce or give any weight or any credibility to some of the statements that are said in allocution. I mean, defendants go up and say they didn't do it when they're, you know, there's a boatload of evidence that says they did. But
it would be better practice for the court to say, I've heard the allocution of the defendant and find that there is no mitigating weight to be given. I mean, then we wouldn't have this problem of wondering what the court did with it.
Well, we know, Your Honor, that the court gave her wide latitude and listened to her very politely for a very long time, but apparently finding that the remarks were either incredible or irrelevant to what she was asking to be done, that would be my suggestion as to why they were not specifically addressed. Is that the better form? I don't know. I can't stand here and say that it is, because I don't want the court to opine that, you know, the court, that any trial court needs to put in information that is that it knows to be false, that it knows to be not supported, that it knows to be specifically contradicted from the record. And one of the things that I would note is certainly the court did say in the letters to Mr. Jackson, she claimed to have been abused by Robert Fingerhut. She stood there and told the jury that wasn't true. She told him in mitigation it wasn't true. You know, it does put the court in the position where they might be doing a weighing process with information that can't be corroborated one way or another. If I may consult with a co-counselor just one second. Thank you. If the court has no further questions, I would thank the court for their kind attention this morning, and we would ask that the death sentence of Donna Roberts be affirmed.
Thank you. Counsel, you've saved 10 minutes.
Thank you. To begin, there are two factual disputes. There wasn't a finding of malingering in this case. What the report indicated was that malingering couldn't be ruled out. In fact, the psychologist had recommended, because of the purported brain damage, that a series of neuropsych testing be conducted so they could determine that was obviously never done. Also, Donna was originally denied SSI. That is what prompted her husband to fight the victim in this case to send the record complaining that it was denied, at which my understanding is after his letter came, ironically, she was afforded the mental disability. So they're
Are you saying that she was receiving SSI?
Yes. That's my reading of the record. If it's incorrect, it's incorrect. But originally she was denied. The husband wrote the letter, and my understanding is she was receiving mental disability from SSI following that. It was
you have that information based on?
The records, the SSI records in this case.
You saw an award letter?
Not an award letter. That was our reading of what was happening, also what our client told us. But so, you know, the court can determine from the record, but if we have a different understanding, no. Is there a specific letter that I can remember off the top of my head? No, I can't, and I don't want to represent otherwise.
Isn't that the problem in this case?
What's that?
Your inability to demonstrate whether or not that critical fact was found to be true by the trial court.
Yes. I mean that's the point. We were denied the ability to open up the hearing to do that, to subpoena in people from the SSI to do all that sort of stuff. Exactly. That is a difficulty. Also, to comment on, she didn't ask for not to be sentenced to death. I don't want to tell you how many trials I've had. I don't want to tell you how many appeals I had. I don't know if I've ever had a defendant stand up and say, don't execute me, you know, because of their it can be taken both ways, particularly if you're in a situation for where you're trying to get any type of expressed remorse or whatever. But I don't remember seeing it done. I don't think that's dispositive of anything that she didn't stand up and ask for. What she did say to the judge is, look, I'm not a bad person, which the judge responded, I don't think you are. So that was said in this hearing.
But in her first trial, she did say that she wanted to have the death penalty.
I thought your assessment that you did a second ago was correct, that her frustration was she did a tirade about how unfair the justice is to African Americans because her co-defendant was an African American. He got the death penalty that because she had come from a better background than him, that she was white, that she should get the same punishment. That absolutely was a motivating factor, and she said that at the time.
And now she's changed her mind?
Well, obviously, because, you know, she could have said, I don't want an allocution.
Pardon me?
I said she could have said, I want to die. I don't want an allocution. I don't want to present anything else. She didn't do that. You know, she came in and she presented things for the purposes of receiving a life sentence. Otherwise, she would have just said, Judge, I'm glad the Supreme Court gave me this opportunity. It's been a number of years, but I want you to know I feel still the same way. She didn't say that. In fact, she presented evidence. Now, you had indicated, I'm sorry, Justice, you had said, you know, why didn't she stand up with these documents and refer to them? The judge had ruled we couldn't use it. So, you know, for us to provide her with documentation that the judge had ruled he would not consider, I'm worried would have gone right
well,
against.
Well, he said he wouldn't open up a mitigating hearing for you.
He found they weren't admissible. That's why we had to proffer it.
As to a mitigating hearing.
That's correct.
We weren't talking about a mitigating hearing. You're talking about your client's allocution, which would not have been precluded to saying, I, in fact, have, you know, treated with Dr. So-and-so, and here's what his report says about me.
Well, then I guess
there's
the
two different things.
Okay, then
here.
I would guess the blame is on us, because the judge, in our opinion, made very clear this stuff couldn't be referred to, the actual documentations. And we,
in the context of reopening the mitigation phase of the case.
He didn't word it that I'm limiting. I ruled you can't use it for that, but you can use it for the allocution.
Pardon me?
I said the judge did not say, I'm not going to let you present it to reopen the case, but you can go ahead and use it for the allocution.
Well, I don't think he had to say that.
No,
there was a motion for a reopening of the mitigation phase,
correct.
And he denied it, and he denied, you know, your use of the record or
that's right.
You know, your information because of that. But there was nothing to stop her from bringing that in at elocution.
Well, then I would concede that that's our error because that was our understanding. And if the court finds we erred, we erred. I mean, there's not much I can say about that.
Well,
that was our understanding.
There wasn't a jury impaneled, was there not?
No, absolutely
not. No, it was right before the judge.
Correct. What I want to close with, what we're doing here now in the judge, we're speculating. We're speculating whether the judge considered these things. We're speculating whether he listened to anything she said. We're speculating whether he gave it any evidence. The statute, 2929.03F, is really a codification of Lockett and Eddings. It requires, you know, so that we can have certainty, so that this court can be sure that a person being executed is appropriate for the execution. That is why the statute is mandatory. The statute said the judge shall identify the mitigating factors and assess whatever weight it is. It's mandatory. In this case, the fear is if this is sufficient, there is nothing in any case henceforth that ever requires a judge to put in their independent opinion that they considered mitigating evidence.
Well, are you familiar with the Phillips case written by Justice Resnick?
Off the top of my head, no.
All right. Well, part of the death penalty opinion that she wrote reads as follows. In the 23rd proposition, appellant contends the trial court's sentencing opinion fails to give effect to all of the mitigating evidence offered by appellant. Appellant erroneously assumes that the evidence is not specifically mentioned in an opinion was not considered. While a sentencing court must consider all evidence of mitigation, it need not discuss each factor individually. And there's some citations. And then she writes, even if the trial court in this case could have more explicitly analyzed the evidence, our independent review will rectify the error. Now, why shouldn't we adopt that analysis in this case?
Because clearly the legislative intent that for accuracy that it be done, that the better practice and the required
practice. That would be the same truth for a mitigation evidence being presented, would it not?
Well,
be the purpose that the legislature says weigh the aggravating circumstance or circumstances
I would agree
against
to that.
The mitigating evidence.
Exactly.
So the analogy to me seems compelling, and I'm asking you why it wouldn't. The legislature has the same thing with the aggravation and mitigation as it seems to have for elocution.
Because the legislature does not require the jury in its recommendation to specifically in a verdict, you know, indicate what it finds. In fact, in federal court, the jury in a death penalty case, it does. The jury verdict in a federal case has each possible mitigating factor and then has the jurors, I considered this, how many found that it was, you know, given weight.
I guess the fact is that our decisions have indicated to trial judges across Ohio it's not necessary to incorporate each mitigating factor in every sentencing opinion.
Okay.
And that is what we've told them. You're suggesting this should now become changed in this case.
I'm
going forward. Is that your argument or
sorry.
Am I missing it?
My argument is that is absolutely what the legislature intended. The legislature intended that this be done in every case. Absolutely.
All right. I think I understand your position.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And counsel, one other thought that comes to my mind, though, if we were to rule in your favor, is there an implication that we now have a new trial court judge?
Yes. There is. The previous judge is deceased.
What does that mean from a res judicata standpoint, if anything?
Well, I think
it goes back, it has to start all over again with a brand new judge, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions. Mm-hmm.